Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, made in France since 1925. The first and finest enameled cast iron cookware and a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's LECREUSET.com.
I'm one of HRN's interns, Nina Medvinskaya, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week's topic? The marriage of food and danger. Sometimes, danger lurks in the food that we eat.
So instead of saying what is poisonous, I'd rather say what's not, because it's literally just the flesh and the fins.
Food poisoning doesn't just threaten our bodies, but it endangers our environment as well.
The emissions of JBS, combined with the other top five meat companies, exceed the annual emissions of Exxon, Shell, or BP.
For more, tune into this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview extraordinary women who work in the world of food and who've made food their life. Today, I have two women who are here from Jamaica, one of my favorite places on the planet. Actually, I've spent very, very happy times there with my family. These women are going to tell us the stories of their great-grandmothers, their grandmothers, I don't know about their mother, themselves, and cooking and bringing joy to people, but also honoring their heritage. So if you'll join me in welcoming Suzanne and Michelle Rousseau.
Hi. Hi there. How are you?
I'm great. I was so excited to read your book, Provisions, which is just being published this very minute, and to get a little bit of your family history and the recipes themselves being the vehicle for bringing the past into the present through your very particular eyes. I'm hoping that you can tell me a little bit about your great-grandmother, who seemed like such a huge inspiration for this book.
Would be thrilled to talk about her. Martha Matilda Briggs is our great-grandmother on our father's side of the family. She's a woman that we had heard about sort of as growing up as children, sort of in the recesses of our mind. It wasn't sort of like everyday conversation. We had a very, very strong, fairly formidable grandmother. We called her Manga, but her name was Enid Rousseau. And Manga's mother was Martha Matilda. So we would hear, I remember hearing about her really because she seemed to have been this fantastic baker. She had this business that was famous for its patties, Briggs patties. She was a stable, strong, imposing woman. My Uncle Pat once remembers, because he would sometimes go there after school to get patties. So he has more memory of her than my father, who would be the youngest child. But we didn't know much else about her. And a big part, I think, of the inspiration for Provisions outside of the food side was that we discovered, in we're looking and researching our first book, Caribbean Potluck, this incredible sort of details and stories about her life that I don't even think members of our family understood or appreciated, that made us sort of have this moment of reckoning about our own life, in both our own life and sort of female lineage, but also even our own story in the food business, that perhaps what we thought we had come to by chance was really in very much a destiny or a completing a circle, and that we really were we had to sort of honor her life in a way we felt that had not been done. And that sort of was a big part of the impetus in the storytelling and the female stories of Provisions.
So tell me, what are some of the stories that you ended up hearing, you know, and how did you find those stories?
So once we had finished Caribbean Potluck, and we had done this research, and we saw that there was just all this information about her that was uncovered, because we did have family members who tried to look back and recreate the original recipe for her famous patty. And,
what is the recipe for the patty?
Oh, we don't know it, actually.
You don't?
No. So we found a handwritten recipe from our grandmother that was probably written in the 70s for our mother to use, but it is not something that is documented or that actually works, because it's kind of sort of, you know, these random things like add water and mix in and use till and it's kidney sweet and all these types of things. But when after that book we decided to do provisions, I started to research her a bit more, and what came to light one day, who knows why or how, was just one little nugget of information that led me to a series of articles and stories and you know, things in the newspaper, the local newspaper, the Jamaica Gleaner.
So she was recovered all the time. I mean, people, yes. She was written about.
She was written about, or she posted or put ads in the paper. So what you have is a series of articles that start from her very first business, which was the Royal Cafe down on Barry Street. And it was opposite Myers and Fletcher, which was the number one law firm of the day. And I think all of the attorneys used to dine there. So one of the first things that I found was a court case where she was defended by Norman Washington Manley for the revoking of her tavern license. That led to a series of other things. She sued somebody for £100 for driving or reversing over her foot.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, indeed. And in that, but then, you know, you uncovered the details through that, because in the story they said that she claims that she lost income because she would make X amount of patties a day at 5 pence per patty, and she would stand on her feet for X hours. So that case was settled, and I think she won £70 for that. And then, you know, just notices to say that her new business had been relocated, that she was no longer owner of this location, Royal Cafe, and it was owned by another woman by the name of Amy Levy, that she was no longer in business with this person. And so she just was clearly a very strong and strident, would be a word that would come to mind, woman in terms of just defending herself and standing her ground in an era where women weren't really in business a lot, you know.
I wonder where that came from. Like, is there a family trait of feistiness?
Yes, without a doubt. Certainly on the Rousseau side, which is my father's side. I mean, my grandmother Manga was known in her day to hold courts in her apartment. And if you came in with an opposing political opinion, you were summarily dismissed and kicked out of the apartment, because she was a staunch defender of the People's National Party and the manly sort of consciousness. And I think that very much would be a legacy that, you know, she must have inherited from her own mother. Martha Matilda was obviously a woman in a time when there were very few colored women that would have been business owners. A successful business owner and entrepreneur. She had multiple businesses. It wasn't just one. It morphed over time into different sort of manifestations. I mean, even in local literature, she's referred to, like, there is a Charles Hyatt memoir, who is a well-known playwright and author in Jamaica, who refers in one of his plays to a Briggs patty being the most sort of revered and coveted patty of the time, and you had to save all your money to get it because it was just so delicious. So she clearly was this sort of figure that, you know, sort of defied the odds at a time, and societally it would have not been that way. It was clear to us too from Michelle's historical research into all of the birth records and all of this, that even though that she had, you know, 6 or 7 children, I don't think she actually was ever married. And she had various different, you know, it was clear based off of the records that we found online with the birth certificates, that she was at different points, you know, a laundress or a seamstress, and then eventually seemed to have worked her way to this other kind of career that then became a very significant, you know, businesswoman with a real career and was, you know, renowned for her skill, which was actually her culinary skill.
Yes, and fascinatingly, what my father's brother said to us is that, which is not evidenced anywhere, but that at one point she owned 3 houses on this street called Retirement Road, one in which she lived upstairs and she had her restaurant on the ground floor, but she also had 2 other locations that she leased out. So to be, you know, a black woman, single, independent, and an entrepreneur, who rubbed shoulders with the likes of Norman Washington Manley and other barristers of the day, was kind of fascinating, to be honest, because I don't think that there are very many women who have a history like that, and if it did exist, that has been documented in such a way.
And now you get to document some of it through the food, but apparently not through the patty.
Not through the patty.
No. And so you became restaurateurs, and did that feel like you were fulfilling a destiny? You said it became clear that you were, but you didn't even really know it.
I don't think we knew that until this, I don't think we knew that we were fulfilling a destiny or coming full circle until we did Caribbean Potluck. I think until then, we just went along, I don't know, maybe it's, you know, youth and just sort of, you know, lack of knowledge and wisdom, thinking that we were just doing a job that we had somehow kind of found our way to, that we kind of had a skill at, that we were good at doing, but that there was this deep sort of connection to the female line, to this lineage, to this legacy of women who had nurtured and cooked, but also had done the same business. That was, I think, very much not aware to either one of us. And I think, I'm not even sure if it was aware to the members of the family until I think we began to talk about it. And I think for us both, you know, it was very much a deep sense of personal need and desire to honor this and honor her and to honor probably so many other women like her whose stories were not recognized or told and whose legacy that, you know, was left sort of to just meander and sort of and disappear into the ethers. So I think for both of us, that felt like a very compelling and important narrative to tell.
So in the book, you say that you dreamt of her. Mm-hmm. What was it like? Did you literally each have a dream and then you woke up and you said to each other at one time or another, can you believe what I dreamed?
Yes, we both dreamt actually separately at different times. Mine was around, I think mine was with my grandmother actually, and we were sitting on a table playing chess or checkers or whatever, and she was writing something down, and for whatever reason I didn't remember the details of the dream, but when I woke up that morning I was like, oh, I know what to search, and I just opened my computer, and that's the day that I found like all the stuff, like the 16. I mean, I think between the year of 1929 and the 1944, there are 13 to 16 mentions of her in the local paper. And what I think there had been a missing search word. I don't know if it was the name of the original restaurant or whatever it was, but I woke up and somehow I just found it. And I think Suzanne's dream was a bit different, and but in many ways we felt that we were channeling them through the work, but also this desire, like I had a very deep-seated desire to just tell these stories before it was too late. Like I felt like we needed to say it as quickly as we could, get it out as quickly as we could. I don't know how.
What was your dream?
I had two dreams. One was a very specific dream with our grandmother, Manga, who we called Manga. She was standing at the bottom of my staircase at home, so beautifully dressed, like she was just luminous. And it's that she was like almost there with me, and she got in the car, she drove with me somewhere where I met Michelle. And it wasn't like there was a specific message, but I just was like, almost like I was talking to her and she was listening, and we were in this conversation until I got to the point where Michelle joined. And I woke up in the morning and I said, Manga had never ever come to me like that. I'd never, ever seen her like this. And she was so beautiful. And I thought, oh my God, what is she saying? What is the message? And that was sort of the first one. And I think there were a couple, you know, months apart, sort of in between sort of the first book and the second book. They were not all at the same time. But the dream with, and then I dreamt about actually Ma Briggs, Martha Briggs as well. And it was just like I felt like I had stepped into this. It was like there was a sense of being in some kind of very spiritual, sacred temple or space. And it's like I remember coming across a threshold, like a doorway. And there was this sense of her presence there and her energy with me and a kind of vague visual of her, which we have a photograph of, so I knew it, and that she was there with me and that there was this crossing over this threshold. That was the dream with her. And I think all of those messages and Michelle's at different points were just all signs, I think, that we took when we began the work, that we were being called upon to translate these stories. Because I dreamt about my other aunt, my aunt Hyacinth Winsome, who would be my grandmother's sister's, twin sister's daughter, and someone that was very, very, very close to us, who died some years ago. I've also dreamt about her, even in this and last year and this year.
I mean, very much, I would say, during the writing, we felt like we had a panel of women surrounding us, female ancestors. And it was almost like they were speaking to us throughout the process, because even as we evolved the story and it changed, you know, it started one way, and then obviously as you keep writing, it begins to write itself, you know, it reveals itself as we go along. And we always had this sense of, for me, it was a vision of a panel of women seated you know, and just
and what
just
were they doing? I love that notion of being surrounded by a panel of women.
Yes.
And what did they bring to you? You know, was it confidence or just, you know, which would be keep going, you're on the right track?
For me, like, it felt very much like, I mean, I suppose for each of us it would be different, but for me it felt like a collective memory. There was a sense of in the retelling, I almost felt like I was there. So there was definitely, okay, is this my past life? Is this someone else's past life? It was very much this this energy of a knowing, is what I would say. A deep knowing, an ability to find the untold aspects of the, from the historical perspective for me now, the untold parts of the story that were there but not said. So by reading what was said and what and looking at what was not said, kind of finding this truth in there. And of course, a lot of that is personal interpretation, but it felt very, very logical, you know, like to draw this particular conclusions to kind of get to where we ended up. It just felt like we were being guided and just told, you know, no, look there.
And you felt the same way?
No, I was different. Michelle and I are very different. Like, we're both very connected, but we get different. I'm very, very visual. So I would say for me, I got a very clear visual of what I needed to do and how the book needed to look. I got this very, very, just very clear sort of understanding that this needed to be a beautiful book. It needed to be a feminine book. It needed to be refined. It needed to show this beautiful side to life in the region and to these the lives of these women, because it was important to make it be known in a beautiful way. And so I got this very clear understanding that, oh, I need to get all the china from my mother. I need to go to this Aunt Winsome's china. I need to ask Aunt Hester for her stuff. I need to go and ask Mrs. Donaldson, all these elders. I need to, you know, go and look at, you know, antique stores, because it really felt compelling to tell the visual narrative in a way that A, had not been told, because I think you often have this very rustic, very sort of roadside sort of aspect to the portrayal of Caribbean food, which in part is true, but is not the only truth. But I needed to show a very clear visual of a domestic life, of the way that, you know, tables are set often and dined at in, you know, special occasions at Christmas and at, you know, holidays or special dinners, but also that these things and these pieces of, you know, china and glassware were actually heirloom pieces that they themselves had used and dined at. So it continued through that legacy of, you know, of handed down pieces that carried within them their own story by the many meals that had been set at tables where they had gathered. And so I think that was more my very, very clear sense. And I think we're different in that we're both, I think, very connected spiritually to the work. And I think we just are, in our process, because of our own personal work and ourselves, have become very in tune. But I think we receive it differently. And I think hence the collaboration brings forth a sort of two-sided sort of narrative, because we both then can come together with what do you think and what do you think. And then I think we're able to expand it from that place. And then we, I think, both felt that we needed to start to incorporate other women's stories. Talk to the women that in our lives had made an impact by what they had cooked, whose meals we'd had or whose drinks or whatever that somehow just stood out in your memory as this very valuable part of your own life that often tells, I think, so the stories of so many of our lives. And then I think that we both got that very, very clearly.
Right. So because a lot of the recipes in the book are your own and you've updated, whatever, some classic recipes. But then, you know, someone down the street makes an incredible, well, you'll have to tell
me. Or So there was a way in which we felt we needed to tell the stories from the perspective of women and through their voice throughout the generations. So even when we looked at modern recipes, we had been reading a lot of these older cookbooks, you know, 18th century cookbooks.
Are there many Jamaican, or you also spent time in Trinidad?
There are very few, actually. And there's a lot of these traditions were orally and manually passed down, you know, from mother to aunt to niece to daughter. So a lot of it that would be discussed in classic cookbooks of the day, in particular one that we use, has references to some of the simpler dishes, but they don't give recipes for that. So there are recipes for more formal things. They spend a lot of time talking about the ingredients themselves. And you know, so for us, even that combined with the modern stories of the women who you know, cooked certain recipes for us, as well as dishes that, you know, that found inspiration from an 18th century cookbook, like a cocoa fritter, or, you know, there was, the, you know, they speak about avocado at breakfast, things like that we said, okay, well, we'll take that and we'll do a modern version of that. But the inspiration largely came from not only how we ate, but also how we saw that they were talking about the food and describing the ingredients and, you know, talking about the meals that they had and the way they had meals, the way they dined, the setting, the environment. And, you know, the dishes and the china were very much a big part of that, in that for many of these women, you know, they were not allowed a domestic life. And so when post-emancipation, you know, the home, domesticity, the refinement of the china and the crystal and the family was very, very important. So many families, even if they could not afford to have an entire, you know, set of china or silver from England, may have had one good cup, one good glass, you know, one dish that they would have used for special occasions. So that then brought into to play not only, you know, Suzanne's visual, which we didn't discuss before, but that's kind of how the stories come together with us, you know. So we're talking, I'm doing this part of the research and she's visualizing it that way. And then we're like, oh, but there's the link, there's a connection. And then it was also that this is how we also eat it. So, you know, you may roast a breadfruit on an open flame, but you're going to serve it on a silver platter or a beautiful china plate. So I think all of that wove itself in. And then the personal stories of the relatives and the friends and the dishes they cooked were also very important in that.
I do think that bringing the elegance that the two of you have, that's in the book and in your lives, is so important, because it's true that so much of the reporting about Jamaica and what people talk about is the great roadside jerk. And, you know, everybody's competing to have the best jerk recipe, which is fantastic, don't get me wrong. Sure. But your book is about all of the ingredients, which is a very modern way to think about food, of course. And it's the way probably your family has been thinking about it forever. Like, what do we have? Mm-hmm. You know? And so the recipes I found to be, except for something like breadfruit, where I was like, where am I going to find breadfruit? But there's, you know, coconut and lime and all of the ingredients that would have been easy to get that form the basis of the recipes. And so I was actually, it made me think about the when you just said avocado, which was called like an alligator pear.
Yeah, or alligator pear or zabuca from zabuca. Trinidad.
And then the Simmons pear is like the most like esteemed, most prized pear or avocado you can eat, because it's this beautiful big, I mean, it's about four times the size of the one you get here. And one slice is probably the third of a small one. But it is the most delicious texture and consistency. And it bears at a particular time of year. And, you know, when it's in season, I mean, everybody has pear at the table with every meal. So, you know, we tend to eat, you know, while avocado toast is now a real thing, we have always eaten avocado or pear, as we call it, as a platter of something served with every meal that you eat, whether at breakfast with ackee and saltfish and plantain and Johnny cakes and blah blah, or at Christmas dinner we'll have a beef Wellington and a roast leg of lamb, and we'll have rice and peas, and we'll have candied sweet potato, and we'll have a great salad, and we'll have a tray of pear, and we'll have plantain in rum. So it's in a way very sophisticated, you know. And I think that felt like a very important narrative to tell, because I don't think it's told. And I think what has happened is that Jamaican cuisine, and by extension the regional cuisine, has been lumped into this sort of like jerk and patties, or these hyper casual, you know, sort of roadside versions of how we eat and dine. And it's really not the truth. I mean, jerk chicken is something that we consume probably out of, you know, on the roadside on the way to the country on a Sunday, or as a snack after a fete or something. That is not the way we sort of eat in our day-to-day lives, or, you know, consume the ingredients. And I think the other important story I think we both felt what we wanted to sort of tell, but also showcase, was that the ingredients themselves are throughout the region, but they have been, they can be presented in extremely modern and elegant and sophisticated ways for any kind of nationality dining outside of the region. And I think for us, the cuisine has been sort of stuck into this one-dimensional portrayal that really doesn't appeal to anybody because they feel that it's inaccessible. And I think for us, we wanted to really show the ingredients, but show the myriad of different ways that not only we eat them, but that they can be consumed outside of Jamaica, in Timbuktu, in Africa, or wherever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of Africa, of course, there's tremendous African roots. And then mm-hmm. Also thinking about all of the people who've come to Jamaica and left an imprint on the cuisine. Absolutely. So it's not like... It's one thing, yeah. And it's represented so often as one thing. We're going to take a break soon, and we'll talk about food after the break. But I have to just ask you, mm-hmm. because two sisters writing a cookbook, speaking to the ancestors, it sounds like you've done it really nicely and easily. But when you're 2 years apart, mm-hmm. when you were growing up, were you close sisters? Were you combative sisters? Is it? I mean, no, you were in business together, running a restaurant for 25 years, so clearly you're close enough, mm-hmm. And you're on two different sides of the coin. But tell me, like, is there, you know, some memorable incident of your childhood that just says it all, like what set you up for today?
I'm sure we each have different memories. I would say we were close sisters. There's a picture which to me is indicative of our relationship, of when I was probably, I don't know, one and Suzanne was three, and we're sitting on a step and she has her arm around me like, mine, you know, this is my dolly. But we were, you know, I think siblings can be close and not close. I think the luckily for us, we're very different, but we like the same things. And I think our personalities mesh well together. So we've always traveled very well together. So even as we were growing up and we were doing different things and what have you, you know, when you think of someone that's a good travel partner or the person that you want to go to the theater with or you want to select a restaurant with, we always wanted to do the same kinds of things. So, and we have a lot of fun together. I mean, at the end of the day, like all siblings, we clash. I'm sure she will have different different versions or memories of our childhood. But I think what has always stood out throughout was that we get along, we laugh, we have a lot of fun. You know, we love to dance, we love to celebrate. We just enjoy life and our time and each other. And we don't take everything too seriously. So that allows us to have that space, you know.
Were your parents surprised that you ended up doing something together?
I don't know, because I think my parents encouraged the closeness. Mm-hmm. I think we were brought up very much that family and family relationships are important, to the point sometimes we're like, okay, enough family now, thank you. But I think they encouraged, I think the gift I think our parents has given us that I think you only realize with age and wisdom is that they really did not define a limit on who we could be and what we could do. They really have supported and were supportive of every sort of nuance and sort of mad idea. And I don't think, to be fair, they understood it always. I think when we said we wanted to do a cookbook or a television show or any of those things that were just outside of the realm of their knowledge or awareness, they kind of probably thought, whatever, they're kind of that's never going to work out for them. But they encouraged us to do it. And I think they're kind of amazed and I think probably blown away by the end result and proud at the same time. And I think they encouraged us to be close. And there was probably a couple of years where we weren't as close when we were sort of in our mid-30s where, you know, there's always family dynamics that you have to work through. And I think we both did a fair amount of work on ourselves and kind of were able to come back to a place where we respect each other and have boundaries in the relationship, but also understand the gift of, A, what we're both good at doing, but I think what we have become very good at an understanding about ourselves is that in some way, whether it's by divine intention or magic or what, we create together. And I think we understand how we create together. And that is a very powerful thing. And I think so where we always went along in our business life, and even as our kids, just as friends, hanging out and enjoying the same things, we didn't understand that in that space of just doing something because we like to do it or because it interested us, there was this kind of way in which we can kind of like put together a narrative of our story or a business or a whatever or an event or a dinner that's just uniquely our spin that somehow somebody else is going to value. And I think what the last few years have done with our work in this product in production and in publishing is that we have become very good and very clear about what we know that we do together that others don't, and mm-hmm. what is our sort of own unique sort of spin or language or magic that we can create.
I think that is the basis of any sort of business that will work, not just the collaboration part, but knowing why you're different. I mean, two other people might do a cookbook and they might, you know, elevate recipes, but they're never going to come at it particularly since there's two different ideas in one.
You have to be very clear about what you're each individually good at. And even if there are spaces that collide or cross over, you know, we have determined amongst ourselves what section or what part we're going to deal with. And then that allows for, you know, an independent thought within your own space that then becomes a collaborative thought once you start to put the work together. But at the same time, we also agreed in business that if we don't both agree to do something, it's a no. So, you know, we kind of set that kind of boundary if we're doing projects together or jointly, that we both have to be 100% on board or the answer is just a no. And so I think that creates, you have to put boundaries in place in family relationships and certainly in business relationships even more so. And what we have become very, very strong at and very good at doing is creating that space where this is the part that we do together, this is the part I do, that's the part you do, and then here's the whole. And that's actually when it gets really good, you know.
Right, I think that's great universal advice, right? Because for both people to have no be no, that sort of probably eliminates a certain amount of conflict, or somebody doing something half-heartedly, like I'm doing it just for you. You don't end up.
Yeah, and I think you start to trust. I think you also, you know, because like along the way, there's been a lot of failures and mistakes as well. So I think over the course of the years that we've worked together, we've also become a lot more confident in understanding, okay, this is what we know how to do well that nobody else does. This is the thing that we can do. So you start to really refine then what do you stay away from and therefore what do you put your energies into. And so your energies are then rewarded.
So what would you say has been a failure that you've had to overcome and that you learned from?
Good question. You know, in business, failures are always opportunities to learn. So, you know, I don't know that I would perceive any of them as failures, but not all businesses that we have done or projects that we have taken on have been as successful. No individual one is jumping to mind right now. There are many, but let me think about it.
Well, I mean, I think that the first part of our business life, we started Ciao Bella and Cafe Bella. There was a period that we decided to come out of the restaurant and go into catering. And I think in that middle road of like not being sure, there were some mistaken, you know, we made some mistakes. I think then we went into catering in a full-time capacity and had to sort of hit the ground running and learn it just the hard, slog it out way. You know, not every event you do we had an event with a huge event with like, I don't remember how many people and like something, this lobster went off or something and it was just like pure
plated
drama.
Dinner for 850 people.
Oh my goodness.
All the lobster
from an
off-site
location.
And then we had, I think we also had a period where we didn't actually know what the answer was. I mean, if I say about failure, I think that there was a period where we were significantly, I think, burnt out. For different reasons, I got divorced, so that was a huge failing I felt at the time on my part. That was a significant part of my own personal learning and growth, and so I've had to sort of figure out a lot as a single mother with two sons, and do a lot of my own personal, you know, work on myself. Which in the end, I have no regrets about because I think they've all been gifts to me. But it didn't mean that they weren't painful.
And it certainly is a way to make you stop.
Yeah, it certainly makes you stop and reevaluate. So I think the person I am today is absolutely not the person I was 10 years ago or 12 years ago. I'm far better than I am, but it was painfully won, if you understand. And I think that there was a period where, with all of that for me and different things for Michelle, we didn't really know what the path was. So I think there was probably a chunk of about 2.5 years where we just did not know. We decided we didn't want to be in catering anymore, but we did not know what the next thing was and how to get there.
Interestingly, it was that break that kind of led to this manifestation, because in that break, that period where we were thinking nothing is working, I had struggled with some depression and I had gone through some things. We took a sort of a pause, and that's when I came to New York to study yoga for a year, and we met our literary agent, you know, through a mutual friend in the yoga community, and who was a published author, introduced us to Joy Tutela from David Black, who at the time we didn't know who she was, but then it turned out to be I remember calling Suzanne. I'm like, so I had coffee with her, and she said she wants to sign us, but I'm going to send her an email and make sure that she knows. She said it's real. So I wrote to Joy. I said, "Dear Joy, thank you so much for agreeing to sign us to your agency." Right? And then at which point I got home, and then I Googled her. I was like, oh my gosh, she's big, you know.
That's so great.
That was sort of crazy.
It was crazy.
The thing about it, I think, at that point when you were sort of in the sort of space of like nowhere and nothing and like, what are we doing? Is all that entire life been a failing? Our work been a waste of time? An external voice or an external perspective that is not connected to Jamaica or to you or anything who validates something about the vision you had was a kind of an affirmation of something Absolutely. So much bigger than either of us could have ever understood, because it kind of it was that sort of tipping of the scale of, okay, maybe we were right in telling the story this way, maybe we're right in what we feel we can do, mm-hmm. maybe we're right in that, you know, there is more work for us to do other than just slogging it out catering for 2,000 people at Cricket World Cup, which is like, you know, no joy after a time. No. So I think the joy was lost, and it at that, and I think if you look back at it now, that was 2011, 2012, 2013. The joy was gone, and we were seeking for work that had higher purpose. That was reflective of our own personal evolution, and that needed to have more. We had to, you know, had a service to it, or it had something bigger that we were doing.
Yeah, it needed to be soulful work, whereas we were doing much more, you know, just, you know, going through the steps every day
to get paid,
and not necessarily being deliberate and conscious. And choosing the kind of work we wanted to do.
And so the way that you got from being sort of lost mm-hmm. to mostly being found mm-hmm. was patience, a little bit of divine intervention.
And a lot of perseverance.
A lot of personal work. I did a few good years of therapy in Jamaica with a very good therapist, as did Michelle. We'd had an amazing coach, like a woman that we worked with each independently for about a year, year and a half. That was very transformative stuff, work, because it asked you to really start to look at yourself.
And be deliberate in your choices.
Your limitations, your weaknesses, your insecurities, but also the vision for yourself, the kind of life you were trying to create.
In many ways, in my mind, I see our life as before New York and after New York, because I think there was such a dramatic shift individually, collectively, in our business, in our consciousness, that we kind of shifted from doing things out of obligation, and the need to prove that you could, or, you know, which may not have been, you know, always what you realized you were doing. Mm-hmm. But I think to a space where we just started to say no, actually. And that comes back to that kind of boundaries thing. We start to say, no, we're not prepared to do that. No, this is the kind of work we want to do. And while people may not have understood it, and we got a lot of criticism for it.
And still probably don't.
Yeah. I think coming outside of leaving your homeland, And coming outside and being here in New York for a while, for me, also sort of took me away from that space of needing the validation of people around me there. Because what I found here, which you don't really get when you come from a small island, is that people accept you at face value for who you are. So if I introduced myself here to somebody as a yoga teacher, they said, okay, yeah. But in Jamaica, it would be like all of the story. But I thought you were doing this. How come you're doing this now? Oh, again, you've changed? Oh, don't you girls choose? You know, it's just always these voices that become your voices that you don't even realize are in your head until you have a little bit of a distance from it. So I think that's after that period of 2012 to now, we've completely shifted how we work together, how we engage with each other, and the type of work that we're prepared to do.
That is really powerful. It's particularly powerful to me as I negotiate these, you know, new waters for me, having done something that I'm so passionate about, and then looking forward to figure out exactly how I move forward to do more things that I'm really passionate about. You know, the transition time is always, you know, rocky's not the right word, but questioning. There's just a lot of questioning that goes into what's the right thing, you know, how much of just staying in motion is important, because they always say, you know, an object in motion stays in motion, it's a good thing. How much is good to actually stop? Mm-hmm. Because when you stop, that's when you could begin to say no. If you're in motion, it's very hard to say no.
Yes.
So, to me, what you've just said is very, very powerful. Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back after a message from our sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, the first to pioneer colorful enameled cookware over 90 years ago. They've been a favorite for generations through the meals and memories the cookware creates and the style it expresses. My name is Kat Johnson. I'm the communications director at Heritage Radio Network. When I'm not making food radio, I'm making food, and my favorite cookware is the 8-quart marine blue Dutch oven that never leaves my stovetop. Before we got our Le Creuset, the cookware we used most often was an antique Griswold cast iron pan. It didn't take long for me to realize how much I'd been missing enamel cast iron in my life. Le Creuset has the superior heat retention of cast iron, but paired with the unparalleled performance and ease of enamel. That means delicious food with easy cleanup. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN, that's LECREUSET.com/HRN, to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
Next year, Heritage Radio Network is turning 10. For the last decade, we've been committed to bringing listeners around the world the very best in food radio, for free. Our small staff and incredible network of hosts work hard so that listeners can tune in each week to hear the important conversations in food policy, stay on the cutting edge of cocktail culture, and hear the latest updates in food tech. But there is no HRN without the support of listeners like you. Become a member of Heritage Radio Network today and help HRN get a strong start to our second decade. Choose from exclusive member gifts and stay in the loop on discounts to upcoming events. There's no better time to show your support. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and wish HRN a happy birthday.
Welcome back. It's Dana Cowan, and you are listening to an episode of Speaking Broadly, where I have the extraordinary sisters Michelle and Suzanne Rousseau, who are in New York City from Jamaica with their book Provisions. And we've talked a lot about the human side of the book, about their ancestors, about how the book came to be. And now I want to talk about food, because I was reading the book in bed and I got so hungry. I was like, instead of actually just, I read all the stories, but I started making a marketing list. I was like, I actually, you know, so many of these things are so easy. I can just go out and buy them tomorrow. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to make the topping. I wanted to make like a green stew, you know, with all of the, like, we don't have necessarily kalaloo, but there's a lot of options for green stews and the tubers. It's like the list was getting very long. So I think one of the great things is your book expanded my mind in terms of what people are eating at home in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. Because the times that I've been in Jamaica, I've been in hotels. Sure. Or at roadside hotels, of course, serve basically continental food. They don't really serve the island food, and sometimes they serve ingredients from the island, but often not. Sort of disappointingly, yes, to me. Yes. But then the roadside, as you were saying earlier, is a small fraction of, I mean, to you it's probably even less than a fraction of what you would eat. You'd eat jerk on the way to the airport, or I always eat jerk on the way to the airport.
We eat after a fete or a party, or yeah, driving to the country on a Sunday, yeah, or in the country we'd go and get jerky for a bit, yeah, of the beach, or, you know, it's just different. Different. We eat it differently, and I think we eat... You know, I think it's really unfortunate that we don't serve more of our own ingredients in the hotels, because I think that's one of the things that Michelle and I have a pet peeve about, that we have these incredible ingredients available to us, yet we sanitize the food for the foreign guests that are coming here, when most of them want to have
authentic
ingredients, I mean, prepared authentic ways.
Absolutely. So from the book, if someone wants to have a taste of Jamaica... Of course, the whole book is a taste of Jamaica, but there's also, you know, there's some Asian influence and there's some Pan-Caribbean. And if I wanted to make something that felt authentically Jamaican to you, which recipe would you choose to say, okay, here's my ancestor in this dish, here's the land or the ingredient, what dish would that be?
It's a very, very, very good question.
Indeed.
Give me a minute to think about that.
And so the book is vegetarian. And there's no meat in the book, but I think it's also just out of respect to the culture where there was so little meat available, right? There's a little bit of salted fish, there's a little bit of meat, but the animals were few and far between, very valuable for other things that they produced.
And typically the typical diet, or what we know as a Caribbean diet, evolved from what would have been the slave diet. And the slave diet was largely built around roasted provisions and small amounts of salted and cured fish or meat, and one pot stews. And so I think, you know, while fresh produce and fresh proteins were available on the island, it would have been, you know, islands, they would have been consumed mostly in the great houses by the planters themselves. And that is a part of the diet that we felt we wanted to be true to in the book, in that building it around those kinds of ingredients. So to go to the ancestor question,
I'm giving you some time.
Thinking about it?
Yes, I am. But I think what that made me think of one thing that maybe would be the roasted provisions with pickles would be a very that would be honoring the ancestors, because we still eat it that way today in many, 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 many restaurants, homes, whatever. They would take the whole roasted, you know, this whole sweet potato, the whole breadfruit, and just roast it on a flame and serve that with a little bit of butter and salt. Or this pickles is a pickle from Haiti, so we always have a lot of pickles.
I also think that, okay, now that I've thought about it.
Yes.
Oh my God.
There's two of you.
I do think that any of the fritters on the fritter platter, the akra, are extremely traditional in ways of serving a light snack. We eat fritters in every form in the Caribbean. Saltfish fritters, they call it akra in Trinidad. But this platter that is a mix of all the different kinds of root vegetables, dasheen and cocoa, and, you know, there's a corn and coconut one, there's the akra. All of those things are, not only are they extremely old, but they are essentially traditional. And whether it's in Trinidad, it's in Jamaica, it's Guyana, it's Dominica, you're going to get them. And so all of those fritters, I mean, it's a regular thing on a Sunday morning to have someone flat frying fritters in your house. Banana fritters. My grandmother made that standardly for breakfast. Saltfish fritters. So the fritters are extremely old and extremely traditional.
Okay, so that's like, I'm horrible at frying things because they come out either greasy or not crispy. What's the secret to the perfect fritter?
Pan fried, not deep fried. A little bit of oil and just pan fry. So a lot of the times they put too much oil.
Yeah.
And another very typical thing too, which I would say is the Caribbean in a bottle, would be all the chutneys.
Yeah, you know, pickles.
And all of those, and the pickles and the chutneys and the jams, and we have a recipe in there for cocoa bread that we've kind of modernized by putting some cheese on it. But in Jamaica, and if you've ever come to Jamaica, you know that cocoa bread, we use that recipe in our restaurant and do fresh baked cocoa
and
bread.
And you know that you'll eat a patty with cocoa bread. That's the thing, as a high school, when you're in high school and you're a student and you don't care about calories, and people still do it now, you get a patty and a cocoa bread, and they open the cocoa bread and stick the patty in it and eat them together. It is insanely fattening, but insanely delicious.
The thing about cocoa bread too is that it has butter layered in. So it's folded over, and it's like a hard dough bread, which is like they've kneaded it enough that the dough is hard. So it has, but they put the fat in there. Oh, it's really good.
So who taught the two of you to cook?
Oh my goodness. I think we just were home cooks that learned. My mother was a great cook. My mother cooked and entertained all the time. My father was always bringing people home unannounced. When we lived in Trinidad, she did a lot of culinary courses because she wasn't able to work, she didn't have a work permit. So she was always doing these dinner parties with Peking duck for 20 and all of these elaborate Chinese meals and you know, this fantastic Guyanese pepper pot when we lived in Trinidad that everybody would sort of be vying for. And my grandmothers were both great cooks. Manga of the Matilda Briggs fame was an amazing cook. And so we kind of grew up around a lot of cooking and entertaining. And so, I mean, I can't even remember when, but I remember cooking, like even when I was in my teens, cooking at home and cooking for like my grandmother's 80th birthday party for, you know, 60 people coming over and having dinner parties while we were at university for our friends.
We do Easter Sunday lunch at university and teas where we make fresh scones and things like that. We always wanted to be, you know, involved in entertaining and food in some way, even if we weren't always cooking the food ourselves. And our dad was in hospitality, so he had some restaurants when we were growing up. So, and my grandfather was the FC, so I was always around the the sort of the money food side.
Yeah. Then, is that a financial controller?
Financial controller, the money guy.
Yeah.
The money guy. So
we grew up around food and entertainment and entertaining at home. And the fact that my dad was both in the hotel and restaurant business also furthered that, even though we didn't really think about that when we went into the business. And I think we were always cooking. We took a trip with our parents sort of while we were in university to Italy, and I remember they took off and went doing off what they were doing and left us with some Jamaican connected friends, some Italians in Rome, who took us with them to their grandmother, Nona, in Forte de Marmi, and they cooked with us, and Nona cooked with us, and we came home and we were making bruschetta the way they did and fava beans. And
we were like, we need to plant a rosemary bush. Rosemary.
We were always cooking, and you know, came home, and I remember my mother stopped going to the supermarket when I came back from university because I began going and doing the cooking at home. So it was just sort of something that we did. We didn't really think about it really hard. I think we were lucky enough to be exposed that we had traveled when we were young with them and traveled and had a lot of good restaurants, exposure to good food. So we just sort of went into it thinking about the kinds of food we like to eat when we travel that we didn't feel you could get in Jamaica.
Okay, so if someone goes to your house, you guys are obviously top of the line entertainers. Like, next time I go to Jamaica, I'm knocking on your door.
You're invited anytime.
And I want to know, like, what... So if you put together, like, a few recipes from the book, because someone's coming over, I love that your mother was clearly prepared for all those people to drop in.
Mm-hmm.
My nightmares are dreams. You know, you have ancestors in your dreams. Mm-hmm. In my dreams, I have people knocking on the door. I'm like, oh my God, I forgot there's people coming for dinner. What is in my pantry? I have sardines. I have tomatoes. Mm-hmm. I've had these dreams where I'm just... It's obviously an anxiety dream. Like, what am I going to feed these people? Not being prepared. But what are you always prepared to serve? And what are those recipes in your book that somebody, like, without, you know, having to do the marketing, like the list I was making in bed last night, what should they make?
It's a very good question.
I would think, I know. For me, from the book per se, I would probably do... one or two of the salads, because there are some amazing salads. I would probably throw on either the kale salad that we do in that book is quinoa. Fantastic.
Describe it.
It's a kale and quinoa salad which obviously kale is very popular, but kale with quinoa, we took the sorrel buds, the sorrel is what we cook. We make the drink at Christmas time, which is what you call hibiscus. Roselles here. We candied them. I mean, I think we've candied them in this and tossed all together with nuts and a limey vinaigrette. It's delicious. It's and feta. I would probably do that, and I would probably take a salmon side and season it with just fresh herbs, zest of orange, garlic, and I roast the whole salmon in the oven. Then I would probably do some planting. Mm-hmm. We have this planting gratin. That's great.
My go-to would be for entertaining that some planting gratin.
And then I would probably throw a starch on there, like maybe roasted sweet potato, or with some like garlicky butter or olive oil and salt. Something simple like that. So you have protein, we have veg, we have something essentially Caribbean, and a platter of pear, obviously.
Yes. Obviously. Avocado. And just to remind anyone, right, who wasn't there at the beginning, the pear is an avocado.
Yes. I would say very similar. I would say some sort of roasted or grilled protein. It could be a beef tenderloin. It could be, you know, chicken that you put on the barbecue. One of my favorite dishes in the book is this, because I'm obsessed with plantain, but is this plantain... gratin, which she mentioned, but it is layered with bechamel sauce.
Wow.
And it has goat's cheese, and it's really, really good with a little panko on the top. But other than that, there's a fantastic eggplant dish in there.
We
love eggplant. So it's just you pan sear, pan fry the eggplant, roasted tomatoes on top, a little bit of feta, some cilantro, a little bit of scotch bonnet oil, and that's also fantastic. So
that sounds like your trip to Italy came back to the kitchen,
yes.
But it met some
some chili. That trip to Italy was extremely foundational for us in, I think, our sort of understanding of cooking simple al fresco Mediterranean cuisine, but bringing that back to Jamaica, because there was really so much similarity into the lifestyle. And while all the ingredients we could get, it was very formative in how we started to look at food and preparing food. This is before we went into the restaurant. And so I think when we started the restaurant, we really took a lot of that sort of that experience and that sort of consciousness into how we wanted to cook the cuisine, but using our ingredients and maybe some of our own local flavors. So I think it actually would be very, very, very point. Well, good point there.
What I would say too is that you know, in the research side of things, in the ingredient part of it, we found that there were so many ingredients that were used and present in markets in the Caribbean in like the late 1800s and mid 1800s that we didn't know about, and they refer often to sweet pot herbs. Sweet pot herbs were marjoram, mint, thyme. You know, those are very aromatic sort of, you know, Mediterranean type herbs. You know, they had eggplants, they call them melangen, or, you know, and they had purple
garden
eggplant. Or garden egg in Jamaica. So all of these ingredients are present. We just cook them in one particular way. So what we felt when we were doing the book is that, okay, if we're going to do an ingredient-focused book, all the things that people perceive as Caribbean ingredients are not from the region anyway, i.e. the salt cod comes from the Northern Atlantic. You know, you have your ackee is from Africa, you have, you know, breadfruit is from Tahiti. So why would it be that you would say that, you know, eggplant or tomato or mint or marjoram is not
would
Caribbean.
Be off the
you
menu.
Know, would be off the menu. Yeah. So we brought a lot of that in, but our favorite forms of preparation are always Mediterranean because we just think of the lifestyle. We live outside, we dine outside, we entertain
it's
outside,
hot.
It's hot.
It sounds great as it's yeah. winter right now as we're talking. Okay, so the last question, speaking broadly, is always paying it forward, because in the way that you've paid it forward with the book to the female lineage, I love paying it forward to the women in the world of food. Is there anyone who you'd like to call out, someone who is a teacher or a colleague or a friend in the world of food who you think all of the listeners of Speaking Broadly should learn about?
Oh my goodness, that's a very good question.
I mean, we've been supported by many women along our path, so it's always hard to identify one. Certainly, Julia Tertian has been, you know, in very much a supporter and very generous in spirit towards us in terms of just, you know, involving us in projects that she's working on and things like that. Can you think of anyone?
I would say, I think there is, it's worth, I mean, it's hard to, some of them are gone, but there were some sort of pioneers in the culinary world of the Caribbean long before it was sexy to be in food. I mean, Enid Donaldson did one of the first Jamaican cookery books back in, I don't know, maybe the 60s or early 70s that we used as something that we cook from daily. When we were away at university and longing out for home, we looked at her recipes.
Norma Shirley was at a restaurant,
par excellence, and a beautiful cook and an amazing, amazing woman. She did collaborate on a cookbook with Rosemary Parkinson, another, you know, I think forerunner in sort of the world of culinary and you know, and books in the Caribbean region at large. Is it Caribbean? Niam Jamaica?
Yes, Niam Jamaica.
And she had another book called Caribbean Culinaria. They, I think, certainly were leaders. I mean, before it was like, you know, the in thing, and I think they did, and they're women that are just, you know, like noteworthy and worthy of just, you know, mention.
I think that's great. Now I want to go look them up. And there are so many women lost to history, and bringing up those, I mean, yes, it's, for me, I'm always thinking about the people who are present to pay it for, too, but I love the New York Times is finding women who've been passed over in every arena, but I'm of course particularly fascinated about those in food. So if people want to buy the book, that's easy to do online, but if they want to follow you, where do they follow you on social?
So we have our social media for our restaurant in Jamaica is at Summerhouse JA. We also are at Two Sisters and a Meal, and we have a website, www.twosistersandameal.com, and our restaurant website is www.summerhouse.com.
Summerhouse.com.
I think.
Okay, well, I have a feeling that if you Google Summerhouse Jamaica, we're going to find the www really quickly.
Yes,
okay, and right now, we're at the end of the winter season, and I want to invite all of you listeners to donate to Heritage Radio Network so we can have another year of amazing food radio. I don't know how many of the shows you've listened to on Heritage, but you should take a listen, go to the website. there's so much information, there's so many incredible hosts, and we need your support. So if you want to support us, go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and any amount helps keep this incredible food radio on the air. So that's it for me. It's Dana signing off. You know where to find me, at FW Scout on Twitter and on Instagram. And I'll be back next week. Have a really great week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.